Welcome to Relevant Tones. My name is Seth Bosted, and Relevant Tones is a podcast about the most fascinating time in classical music history, which is right now. And no, I don't know what classical music means anymore either. Let's not even get into that. We're here to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the publication of the book Working by Studs Terkel. Yeah. So we do three or four of these Relevant Tones live shows. I love doing a live taped podcast here at Symphony Space, and we always have a theme for them. And so I'm really excited to welcome a couple of special guests. But first, my co-presenter for the Relevant Tones live series is Todd Lippe, who is a Renaissance man. He's an artist, a designer, a curator, a musician, I don't even know, there's so many other adjectives. And for many, many years, he's run the Asopus Foundation. Big hand, please, for Todd Lippe.
Thank you.
When I get boring, Todd will step right in. My name is Seth Bosted. I'm a composer. I actually wrote one of the pieces tonight. And I'm also the executive director of Access Contemporary Music. We are a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. We're always changing our mission. And we also are the ones who produce the Relevant Tones podcast. And my special guests tonight are Dr. Anna Tabas. She is clinical professor and chair of the Human Capital Management Department at NYU, co-author of Humans at Work. Really excited to have Anna here. And our other special guest is Eric Loomis, who is professor and director of graduate studies at the University of Rhode Island, author of numerous books, most recently A History of America in 10 Strikes. Todd and I just met Eric and Anna like an hour ago or something, so this will be a pretty freewheeling conversation. I'm going to ask some questions, and let's just get the conversation going. And we're going to have performances in between of pieces that we commissioned for tonight. Everything you're going to hear is either an improvisation like we just heard or a world premiere of a piece that relates in some way to Studs Terkel and to the concept of working. We'll hear the composers talk about that. And those pieces will be performed by the wonderful Black Oak Ensemble. Super excited to have them here. Okay, let's talk first about Studs, this book, Working, 50 Years of Working. Anna, Eric, either one of you or both of you, can you talk about what that book meant for you personally? What is the importance of that book? Let's talk about that.
Well, sure. First of all, thank you for having me here. And having listened to John Zorn for 30 years, it kind of blows my mind to actually be on stage with him. So it's like super cool for me in a lot of ways. But when Working was published in 1974, that was a really transformative time of work in America. It's a period where the big post-war boom has ended, where that generation of people who had lived through the Great Depression is starting to move into retirement, and you have a new generation of people coming up into the workforce who are not very happy with their jobs, like the kind of things that, that people were happy to have, just having a job in 1942. They're not happy with that in 1972. You had just had the Lordstown Rebellion, which was this moment in at a GM factory in Ohio in which the workers kind of struck against the employer and the United Auto Workers at the same time. And there's this Lordstown syndrome of all these young people who are really unhappy. And Studs Terkel really captures a moment in American history through these amazing oral histories that he does. And, of course, that was his specialty, and he published so many great books doing this. But these conversations that he's having with people across the country in almost every kind of work imaginable really is this incredible historical document that I still think frames a lot of how we can think about work today. So to me, it's really one of the most important books ever published about labor issues.
I picked up a copy of the book a few years ago in a secondhand bookstore, and what I loved about that particular copy was the comments that whoever owned the book before left on the pages of it, and even scribbled the cursive that I really enjoyed reading along with the text of the book. My approach to this particular document is more from today into looking back into the past and what work used to mean to people in the 70s and before. And reflecting more on what impact of that type of history of working has on today and what parallels we can see in today's workplace, because that's my specialty. I look at the workplace of the future and write about it, thinking about what the new technologies might mean and what is that psychological contract that people have with the work that they experience on a day-to-day basis. And it's a really interesting reflection on how much progress we've made. In fact, I have a much more probably, Eric, optimistic view of where we're going rather than just reflecting on what work used to be coming out of the industrial age. And that's, I think, that's the theme that I want to kind of weave through the conversation today, not only looking at the labor and the burden of work, but also at how much we can change our relationship with work and what it means today.
Wow. I mean, obviously work has changed a lot in 50 years since Studs Terkel's time. But Todd, did you have any specific thoughts on Studs and working?
I'm a sucker for the encyclopedic approach to anything, and I felt like his
devotion
to interviewing everybody who had done anything related to a labor situation, from a welder in Detroit to Pauline Kael. You know, like the breadth of interviewees he came across was just, to me, a real testament to his desire to really document something fully and completely.
I think, you know, Anna, Eric, and I'm just curious, work is so ubiquitous. I mean, everybody has a job or you know, is looking for a job or just got fired from a job or, you know, I mean, we all think about work. It's one of the first questions we ask somebody, what do you do for a living? But prior to Studs, had anybody really investigated work in this depth? I mean, is that, you know, it's really something that is so ubiquitous, it's almost invisible. Like, I almost never think about it. And when I was rereading Working recently, I was thinking, oh my God, that's right. Like every single thing on this stage was made by somebody. Everything, and not only made by somebody, but transported by somebody. And, you know, and that's a really fascinating thing. So I'm just curious, you know, about, had anybody really examined work in that kind of multifaceted detail that Todd's talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm coming from and looking at work is that particular segment of history from the Industrial Revolution to pretty much today, and how it's changing is a snapshot of a particular relationship with between humans and machines. But if you look at the previous generations of working and relationships again with work, if you look at artisans communities and even the Stone Age, I mean, humans worked all of their entire history. And I do think that what Terkel is capturing is that particular industrial revolution to the end of the 20th century. And I see it as a transitory. And I know that we can argue that a lot of it still remains to be acute and relevant for today. But I do think that it's just a historical moment. But that relationship with work has been continuously evolving. And if you think about the farming, the artisan communities where people lived, where they worked, hybrid working, speaking about it, or working from home. Mm-hmm. The majority of work was done from home. Mm-hmm. It's only in starting with the Industrial Revolution where urbanization started and people moved into cities and the commute came about, et cetera. That kind of industrialization and mechanization of labor is what created that particular historical moment, but I do think that we are entering another age of working that I would be happy to.
But isn't the Industrial Revolution, isn't that just an outgrowth of humans using tools, and we invented tools to try to save us from work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and then it was kind of ironic that,
it
you
is,
know.
It is and it isn't, but because we always had tools, right? But if you think about axe, if you think about wheel, if you think about other types of tools, agricultural tools. So it's industrialization itself and mechanization of work that created those, in particularly inhumane conditions that we've seen reflected even still in place in some places today.
Eric, can you react to all of this?
Well, I think that there had been investigations of work in the past. A lot of them, at least in the American context, had come out of reform movements and things like this, right? So in the early 20th century, you know, there's an anarchist who walks up to President McKinley and just like shoots him in the gut and kills him. And then, you know, 1910, the Los Angeles, the Iron Workers Union leadership bombed the Los Angeles Times building because the LA Times was this radical right-wing, super conservative newspaper, and this began to get people's attention. And the government, particularly the Wilson administration, was like, hey, what's going on here? Like, why are anarchists shooting our presidents? So they create something called the U.S. Commission on Industrial Relations, which goes out and interviews this like vast array of people around the country, and it's this really fascinating moment. But what Terkel, so yes, there had been investigations of work that if you really like were engaged in this field, you might know. What Terkel adds is the oral history component, right? That's what he's critically doing here. You know, oral history as we think of it really, I think, comes out of the 1930s. And in the post-war period, thanks to, you know, his radio show and his amazing ability to interview people, he's really able to become what is in many ways a very pioneering oral historian, and really just allowing people to talk, right? These previous investigations and things, I mean, they're the agenda of whoever's doing the investigation, the government or whatever, or whatever side of this they might be on. Terkel is just saying, please tell me about your experiences with work, which, as Anna says, is a central component to every human society that's ever existed, right? And so when we're thinking about the future, I think, and maybe Studs would agree with this, like there's going to be some kind of work. I don't know what it's going to look like, but every society has had work. How we organize work, the values we place on work, who controls the work, those are contested and incredibly varied across the history of human societies.
And if I could just jump in here and think about the medium, it's also kind of historically specific. Oral history, totally agree with you, Eric. But now we're seeing those voices coming out on their own. There are media that allow every worker to express how they feel, and I think we're social media, right? And there will be other ways of those voices to be heard. And from that point of view, even the kind of cacophony of voices that are available to us now, obviously the media journalism is trying to capture and codify it into trends, et cetera. We talk about quiet quitting, you know, the branding that occurs around, you know, what are the latest trends and hybrid working, et cetera, whatever the media decides to highlight. But I do find, Eric, that kind of how the work gets expressed and socialized into the broader conversation is also changing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think that in some ways, you know, it may get in the way of the kind of political organizing that has taken place in the past to build unions, right? Because, we really live in such an individualistic, expressive culture that I think that really could get in the way of the kind of hard, intense organizing, whether we're talking about workplace organizing or even other kinds of organizing as well, that, you know, it's so much easier to just spout off on Twitter or whatever Elon Musk is calling it today than it is to actually, like, sit down and, like, form that union, you know? And the kind of quitting culture that we have. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who's out in Texas, and his kids were involved in like organizing some pizza places in Austin, and you know, they were all involved in everything. And then I asked, "Hey, how's it going?" He's like, "Oh, they just kind of quit, right?" Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of, I think, you know, this kind of like, "Well, I'm not going to stick around with this job. I'm just going to kind of like say, you know, hell with it and go on to something else." Is a phenomenon of our time. And also one I think that is very understandable. I'm certainly not going to tell somebody to work some crappy job they don't want to be at, but also is potentially a political barrier.
We'll come back to the conversation. Oh, yeah. I want to get a piece of music. We have so much to talk about. I don't want anyone to think that I'm quiet quitting right now. All right? I'm loud quitting.
You're
I'm out of here.
Quitting.
No, but this is all. We're getting into the meat of it now. So I do want to make sure we do a piece of music. And our first composer is Shannon Stryker, who unfortunately broke his ankle recently, not working while recreating. How about that? Huh? You see? You take some time off, and what happens? You break your ankle. So I'm going to just kind of hand the microphone back to him, and he's going to talk about the inspiration for his piece.
So the name of this piece is called I Give Them Music, and it's based on Stud Terkel's interview with elementary school teacher Rose Hoffman. Rose spoke quite a bit about how important habits and routine are for maintaining classroom management. And I really love her honesty in this quote. She says, "Habit. This is very boring, very monotonous, but habit is a great thing for these children. They love the idea of habit. And then after a day of habit and rituals, she would reward the students with music and art. And this is where the title of my piece comes in. This is a quote from her. It says, "I give them music too. That's up to me, up to my throat. They love music." And I personally connect to giving children music quite directly, as I've taught music in the New York City public schools for almost 18 years. And unlike Rose, I have the joy of only giving them music all day, all 500 students each week. yes. The majority of this composition you're going to hear explores the feeling of habit, routine, and repetition, and all those special moments of joy and beauty that can be found during these practices. But then, at the end, the students get to sing a very simple song, and it brings them deep, deep pleasure.
Thank you, Shanon. Let's bring out the Black Oak Ensemble, please. All right, and now the Black Oak Ensemble is going to give the world premiere of I Give Them Music by Shanon Estreicher. This is the first time anyone has ever heard this piece, which is, I think it's super cool. So, hope you all enjoy. Thank you. Performance of I Give Them Music by Shannon Estreicher, performed by the Black Oak Ensemble. We'll hear more from them later on in the program. Wow, so we were really getting into it there, and then I stopped it. I was like, let's just have some music now. But let's get that energy back. Boom. So, Eric, you know, you were talking about this idea that it's easier to spout off on X, or it's easier to, you know, complain than it is to form a union. And Anna, it seems to me that you think that work, by and large, is getting better for people. I mean, is there a dichotomy here in your viewpoints? Eric, do you still feel that, by and large, I mean, there are companies out there, I don't want to get sued, so I'm just going to call this company Amazon, but like there are companies that we know, you know, make people like run around and they get fired by text, and you know, so this still exists. I'm just curious, you know, is it getting better? And Eric, do you agree with that, or do you think that we're still more or less where we've always been?
Well, I don't think we're exactly where we've always been, but the nature of work has changed. I mean, one thing you are seeing right now is a tremendous dissatisfaction with work, right? You have, you know, the highest number of strikes since the early 1980s, really since Reagan busted the air traffic controllers. You have these campaigns at Amazon and Starbucks, and you have the UAW trying to organize the South again. And now unionization numbers have not ticked up, but you know, in addition to the, you know, I think one thing the pandemic did is it created a scenario in which a lot of people really rethought their position vis-a-vis work, right? Because they were being paid to stay at home. And, you know, they realized maybe I don't have to work, you know, these 12-hour days. Maybe I don't have to commute in 5 days a week. Maybe I don't have to work three jobs, you know. And you see these teacher strikes as another example. Where you see, you know, teachers who are so underpaid that, you know, they're going on strike in part so that they can actually make enough money so that they are, like, preparing for class for instead of driving an Uber at night. So I think that there is this tremendous dissatisfaction with work. I think when you go back and read Working, certainly you realize that some of the danger, the brutality, and the physical difficulty of a lot of labor has changed a lot in that half a century. But coming out of those communities, you know, my dad worked in the timber industry, and I got family in ranching and these sorts of things. There's also something lost there, right? There's a lot of anger. When you think about the anger of so much of the working class today, a lot of it is the loss of the dignity of labor, as bad as those jobs in many ways really were. So it depends on how you look at it. Are things getting better or worse? I don't know. They're different. I tend to be somebody who, I guess, is trying to listen to what's going on at the workplace and thinking about it in those terms and sort of chronicling the ways in which people are acting on how they are managing work. But work is a lot different than it was 50 years ago. I think there's no doubt about that.
Anna?
I think if the benchmark is unionization and kind of labor relations and industrial relations of the last century, clearly everything has changed. A lot of things changed. But I think what's most important is what's changed is people's relationship with work. Eric, yes, people stayed at home and worked at home, but look at the kind of damage that occurred. It's mental health issues, burnouts, and in fact, from statistics alone, we know that people actually work a lot more. The boundaries that the commute has set up in various types of social relationships outside or, you know, casual connections at work, et cetera, all of those connections disappeared and people burnt themselves out on working from home. In fact, we know that people do not want to work from home. They want a hybrid relationship. They want flexibility. And I think the other thing has changed is the expectations of work. We talk about generational differences, the expectations of what people need to get from work, the kinds of respect and rewards that they expect to be receiving from work has, you know, those expectations have been raised. And that's part of the change that we are experiencing. It's not just that, you know, people all of a sudden found that working from home is better than commuting. We know that that's just part of the challenging change that we're seeing in the workplace. And to the point of who is speaking and whose voices we're hearing about work, in fact, we can argue that the ability of people to organize outside of union, through social media, find different kinds of communities and connections has increased because of the different relationships that they can build through, remote connections that it can build through the media, for example. So I think there are multiple moving parts, and it's going to be very one-sided to be judging everything by the way people organize into labor unions. Even the labor unions themselves, I think, will have to live with that changing reality and how workers are going to organize at the time in the age of AI as something to be defined. And I think we need to be looking at the innovation that occurs because people are dissatisfied, but it's driving a certain level of innovation of how people organize around their work and how they protect themselves and voice their concerns. All of that is changing as we speak. And I think the lessons we can learn from Terkel is that it is also time specific. A lot of that pain is expressed in the book, but we should be looking for the signals of that new voice, new expression, new media, new forms of organizing in the current work environment.
I was thinking about this. There's been a lot of talk recently. There's a book that's just about to come out or has just come out, and I'm forgetting the author's name, but he's talking about the sense of isolation among particularly young teenagers and young people, expedited and like put into overdrive by social media, in the sense that you feel like you're connecting, but are you really connecting? And you were saying earlier, it's easy enough to write a post saying let's organize something. It's really easy to just like it and feel like you've done something incredibly important. And I just think about all these people who came into the workplace like 2 or 3 years ago and don't want to go into an office and work. They're happy at home. They like the idea of having that freedom and not having to wear a suit, et cetera. But I think, I say to my nephews and nieces, listen, a workplace is a social environment. You can make relationships. You can learn how to, navigate things politically by being around people, by observing them, by having them observe you, by being them available to you at any time you have a question. You don't have to try to get on a phone call. They're right there. And I think that's a really important part of any work. I mean, it could be terrible too, it can be toxic, but I think that idea of having this social, this community of people is really important to any kind of...
The data doesn't support the narrative that young people don't want to go to work. In fact, that's the opposite. Mm. It's the opposite. Yeah,
it's
young
my
people,
anecdotal
is
stuff.
Is it the commute people, then? It must be the commute.
No, it's not the commute. People. It's the 30s plus to 40s, people who have families, who have already established work relationships, et cetera. We're seeing it in the educational system. Our students want to be in the classroom. Our faculty don't. And we have that disconnect. We have this disconnect because the faculty want to teach from home. It's
right.
Convenient. The students are after every semester, I get complaints from the students saying, not enough classes in person. Mm. People want to be socializing, building community, not even if they just want to be going out after class.
Right.
So I think there's a generational difference, and there's a danger of kind of buying into the narrative that everyone wants to be working from home because it's convenient. And I think it's ageism if we say it that way.
Reverse ageism.
Well, I think that, it's funny that you mentioned that, because the academic thing, because, I mean, a lot of the ways in which we're thinking about these things right now is so pandemic-oriented. And let's face it, the pandemic was like, paradise for the person who doesn't really like to be around other people. There's a lot of academics who fit into that, that category. Yeah,
and comic artists.
And so certainly, yes, I am an enormous proponent of in-class education, and I refuse to teach online entirely because I think it's terrible. I think that certainly what Anna describes in the academy is very true, is a lot of academics really just like never want to see people again. unfortunately, that's terrible for the students, and at least at my institution, and that, you know, includes, you know, we have a strong union and I'm treasurer of that union. You know, we are also like, it's part of your job to be in person. And I do think that's a very important thing, especially when you're dealing with young people.
But so Anna, part of your Humans at Work book, if I'm not mistaken, is a lot about hybrid working, right? I mean, this is something you're thinking about a lot.
Yeah.
The hybrid workplace is here to stay, would you say?
Absolutely. I think the solution is in the hybrid. And this is where I see a reflection back across ages into the more artisan communities. I think we're bringing in new organization around work. And I also think that with the innovation that's happening around the tools that we're going to be using, there is that proximity and socialization is going to be much more authentic. To your point about social media being just the very first generation of trying to connect remotely, I think we're learning a lot by experimenting with it. And I'm always looking at the opportunities to what's new, what's innovative, about what we're trying to do now with the workplace. And I see a lot of desire for proximity, authenticity, and immediate contact, even at a distance. Mm. You know, how can we recreate that, that sense of authenticity and proximity without necessarily having the ability? It doesn't mean that we don't want to be with people, but if we don't have this opportunity, and I'm looking at other outside of work. If you think sports is work, if you think medical, you know, care, wellness is a work in a sense, access is just as important. So I think, we are going to be experimenting with different ways of proximity to work, and whether we are going to be co-located or remote, but it's all going to be hybridized. And what the employers are really thinking about right now is the quality of presence, right? If we are bringing people together for 3 days, let's think about maximizing that presence together, just like we're here in this performance conversation. You know, how do we make the most of it so that people connect authentically on important topics, and the work that could be remote, you know, could be done in isolation, et cetera. And what's really interesting, and I think we all have to be watching out for that trend, with AI and other types of tools, it's the remote work that's going to get automated. I keep telling my students all the time, you know, if your work could be totally remote, it could be very easily automated. So I think it's the type of jobs, the work that will need to be creative, innovative, and other types of activities, that work is going to stay person to person, and then everything else could be automated through algorithms and AI.
And I want to pick up on the automation thing after our next music break, because that's a big topic, needless to say, that we're going to solve tonight. Let's bring up our next composer, Natasha Bogoyevich. She's going to tell you about her piece.
Hello, New York. So good to see you here. And my composition is titled Hi Ho. This is one very busy piece. Why is it busy? Because it's related to the event. And of course, that musicians has something to do while playing. So there are three main leitmotifs in the composition with a lot of different articulations and sounds that you will hear, but mostly try to recognize hi-ho. because hi-ho, hi-ho is what we sing off to work or from the work we go, or we dig, 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 dig. These are American classics, I believe. And also, there is one more leitmotiv. It's, you'll see it. I was going to whistle, but I can't whistle. But most of us, we whistle while we work. Ta-da-da-pa-pa-pa-pa. So, hope you like it.
I work from home, and you know, every morning when I go from my bedroom to the office, I whistle one of those tunes as I go to my home office, just so you know. All right, let's have the world premiere now of Hi-Ho by Natasha Bogoyevich, once again, Black Oak Ensemble. Thank you. Okay, so hi ho, this idea of somebody going to work cheerfully, you know, I love that idea. Let's talk about enjoying our work. Let's talk about this balance between enjoying what we do, doing what we do because we have to make a living and pay our rent. I mean, there's that phrase, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And I feel like for myself, I enjoy most of what I do, but I'm always thinking to myself, maybe in a year, I won't have to move a microphone stand. Maybe in 5 years, I won't have to do, you know, QuickBooks for Access Contemporary Music anymore. Somebody else will do that. We're always trying to improve our lot and you know, kind of whittle down to the things that we really want to do, but get paid equitably for them. Can we react to that idea?
Well, for one thing, I'll say that all the iron, you know, it's kind of ironic because Walt Disney was such a horrible employer, and his animators go on strike, and I think what 40 or 41. And if you look at the timeline of the top quality Disney movies, they're all really before that. Mm-hmm. He never really recovered because for all Disney might want to talk about work in Snow White. He liked to basically be a tyrant and like pay the same pay people doing different the same job like radically different wages depending on how much he liked them and whatever. And so he was incredibly bitter about this. So, it kind of goes back to, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, something like let's say the kind of world in which Snow White is supposed to appear or take place. It was an artisan world. I mean, if you look back at the 19th century, a lot of the struggles over labor. It's a little hard to explain this in a way that really like matters to students these days because it wasn't so much about wages and it wasn't so much even about hours. It was about control over labor, right? It was that I was an artisan and I control how I was going to do things. And a big part of what employers are trying to do in the 19th century, and then it's really destroyed by Henry Ford, is to, you know, to strip control away from from workers. And that was like the Ford deal, the famous Ford $5 a day was, I'm going to pay you, but I'm literally going to treat you like a machine. And you were going to have, you know, you're going to have like no control over your work at all. And by the time you get to working in Studs Terkel, like the vast majority of living Americans, that had been their lives. And that like pre-1900 kind of artisanship in which you really did have pride over your work and you really thought you were making something. I mean, that's largely gone, and I think it gets reflected in the book with the kind of unhappiness or even bitterness that a lot of people feel as, you know, as they feel like they should be satisfied at work because everybody in America says, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps or whatever, but they're not satisfied at work.
Yeah. So, again, that psychological contract that people have with their work has been progressively changing through the last century and today, I think the technology is accelerating this process. Daniel Pink, who is not considered to be a researcher, but is really a trendsetter sort of, and really has a great knack for developing a new language around how we think about work. He talked about autonomy, mastery, and purpose as key motivators for people to be satisfied with their work. So it's autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So what Eric just referred to is that sense of autonomy. I think the one thing that was lost with industrialization, regardless of how hard the labor was, is that sense of autonomy over your work, right. Over your time, over your final product, everything. Is people just really, it was a industrial form of slavery, if you were. Mastery, what we know now from all the psychological science, is people want to be continuously learning and changing. And if they don't see that progress that they're making at work, that also becomes very stifling and dissatisfying. And the last thing that has sort of come into focus in the last century, and in this century, is purpose. That's something that in the traditional labor formula was not considered to be an option, right? You just work for your employer. Now we are talking about everyone kind of discovering a purpose of their work. And, you know, this could be a cliche for those of you who are in the kind of studying workplaces, but you look at the same worker, you know, this parable of a bricklayer, you know, and you ask one bricklayer, what are you doing? And he's saying, I'm laying bricks. You go to the other bricklayer right next to him and you ask him, what are you doing? Oh, I am building a wall. Yeah. And you go to the third one, again, right next to him. What are you doing here? Oh, I'm building a cathedral. And so that kind of changes the perspective. And a lot of it has to do with how people see their work. And so I think that what's, you know, those employers right now, obviously, you know, the trickle-down economics, et cetera, and Milton, kind of more traditional economic theory from the last century, end of the last century, and even remaining today. But that's also changing. We really are thinking about those employers, and these are new companies that are coming in that are trying to really lean in to the sense of purpose for their workers. How do we communicate it? And a lot of it is saying, oh, that's just corporate communications, you know, and massaging of the corporate message. But there's a lot of companies that are really taking that sense of purpose for their workers seriously and are investing in building all of those three components and whatever means they're finding for themselves. Again, it's autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Yeah. The time we have for conversation is starting to dwindle, so I want to jump into something that I think is really important to talk about. I want to make sure we touch on it. Which, you know, I think, so I'm in a unique position because I'm an employee, but I'm also an employer. Our nonprofit employs around 20 people. Many of them are teaching artists in our schools in Chicago. And, you know, there's a constant push to raise wages, and I'm all for it. I want everyone to have everything that they need. But every single human being is so expensive to give them everything that they should have. And I think to myself, is this really the job of the employers? In this country, it's all pushed onto the employer. And I think, how much of this should be the government? And then I start to think about universal basic income, and I start to wonder, yeah, right. And I start to think to myself, like, I mean, why should this all be on, you know, what if you're in the gig economy, or what if you're doing several different jobs, and you can't have this thing? And then I wonder, I mean, going to your point of autonomy and purpose, I mean, if you didn't have to work to make a living, you know, if you had the things that you needed, what would people do? And how productive would we be? Can we? I just want to make sure we talk about that, because that's super important, and I'd love to hear what you all have to say about that. Mm.
Well, I'm an extreme not utopian, the American worker is so massively more productive than they were when Studs Terkel was working. But if you look at who has captured those profits, it is entirely the employer class, right? The income of the American worker has been absolutely flat for 50 years, despite this massive productivity. So I don't see how AI or anything else is going to change that.
Anna, you have thoughts, I assume?
I think we need some music before I answer.
Okay, all right, let's do it. All right, let's do my piece. So we'll bring out Black Oak Ensemble again. This is a piece that I wrote directly in, I was rereading Working. And as we've mentioned, you know, there's a kind of a lot of people are complaining about their jobs. And there's a guy that works in a factory, and he basically says, who can you sock? Meaning, who do I get to punch? You know, I'm so mad. There's no X back then. You know, who do I get to sock? And I almost called my piece that, because that really, like, resonated with me. And I also want to say I know the Black Oak musicians very well. I've worked with them for many, many, many years, so I know what they can do. So I knew immediately I wanted to write a hard, fast piece for them, because I knew that they would just, like, do it. And I used to work at WFMT, Relevant Tones, the podcast we're taping, began life as a syndicated radio show at WFMT in Chicago, where Studs worked for a really long time, where he did his radio program. I never got to meet him, but I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the folk movement that Studs was part of in Chicago in the 60s and 70s. I used to work at the Old Town School of Folk Music. So this piece is this kind of like, who can you sock, you know, edgy, angry, fast, Americana, you know, in your face, patriot, non-patriot, I don't even know what. And I called it Hardly Working because when I was in college, I worked at the sub shop delivering sub sandwiches. As my manager put it, any asshole with $6 can make us drive to their house with food. And there was a guy who would come in every Saturday afternoon and he would say, working hard or hardly working? So I give you Hardly Working, performed by the Black Oak Ensemble. Thank you. right, on that note, Anna.
You know, what I'm thinking is we've got to innovate. You know, to say that that's what unions, the way they are, have worked for us before, therefore we should use the same tool now. And I do think that there are different, there's an evolution in innovation. First of all, I think that the class that will need to be really worried about protecting themselves are the, what we call, white collar workers now. Because that's where the next level of innovation is going to hit most.
Meaning automation, right?
Automation, yeah. The next level of automation is going to, so, and that's the group that probably, yes, some schools have organized and, you know, and we see the writers' union, et cetera. But I think we need to be thinking about whether the same kind of union are going to work for people who will be affected most by AI, for example. So that's one level of innovation. The other is, and I always go to this, my favorite quote, we have Paleolithic minds, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. So how do we reconcile that tension? Because we can't just say, you know, well, again, go back to 19th, 20th century, and looking at, you know, how, you know, we protect our ability to own our own fruits of labor, right? And be compensated and rewarded for it. And, you know, outside of American history, if you think of some of the European models, like German Workers' Council and the consultations that are happening in the European institutions, and obviously a different taxation system, et cetera, all of it will have to happen at a massive level. But I do think that just approaching the current challenges with a nostalgia for the past is not going to solve it. I don't have a solution, but I'm saying that we need to innovate in the way we protect people, labor, and at all levels, has to just move as fast as the technology and tools that we bring to make us more efficient, more proficient, and more productive.
Do you agree with Eric's point, though, that from, say, you know, the hydroelectric despotisms of Sumer and Egypt to today, that humans, by and large, exploit other humans?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's kind of part of human condition, I think. And how do we, and, you know, in our ideas of inclusion, democracy, and all of those kinds of institutions, and as you know, even the democratic systems are now at risk all across the world. So again, that's to the point of medieval institution and nostalgia for the past. I think we need to be investing just as much in how we innovate our social systems, governance systems. Big conversation right now about how do we govern AI, having learned what we've learned from social media and the, you know, aftermath of that. So I think, yes, for the time being, I think, you know, unionization continues to happen, and I am all for it, but I think we need to be, and Eric, you may be plugged into what happens with the unions and how they're changing to address a much more dynamic system of, you know, automation.
Okay, let's bring out Black Oak Ensemble for our final piece, and the composer and performer, Alicia Walter, as well.
Yeah.
And Alicia, please, you have such a wonderful story. Tell us about this piece.
Yeah, so I was a bit flabbergasted when Seth reached out to invite me to partake this evening because he didn't know this, but I actually have a family member who was basically a grandfather to me who was interviewed in Working.
Whoa.
Yeah, his name was Hotz, and yes, that's H-O-T-S, Hotz Michaels. He was a piano player in Chicago, and my mom thinks that he and Studs were acquaintances that ran in similar circles, but Hotz played at the Sherman Hotel for years in Chicago, and NPR actually released the tape that Studs interviews Hotz on, and you can search, if you search for it online, you can listen to the tape, and it's so interesting. He's talking about his history, or his future as a piano player, And I mean, this is like the most full circle thing ever. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, this piece, it gave me a great reason to read the book. I had only ever read Hotz's 3-page chapter. And as I was reading, I was kind of just jotting down anything that jumped out to me, either personal stories or thematically, and ended up writing sort of a condensed song cycle that we are about to perform. Thanks all. It is about a search for daily meaning as well as daily bread, for recognition as well as cash, for astonishment rather than torpor. In short, for a sort of life rather than a Monday through Friday sort of dying. Perhaps immortality is part of the quest. To be remembered was the wish. Ought not there be an increment earned, though not yet received, from one's daily work in acknowledgement of man's being? I was constantly astonished by the extraordinary dreams of ordinary people. No matter how bewildering the times, no matter how dissembling the official language, those we call ordinary are aware of a sense of personal worth, or more often a lack of it, in the work they do. Working, working, but is it working for you or for me? And turning, yearning, oh how I'm searching, what could it be? Nora Watson, editor. Jobs are not big enough for people. It's not just the assembly line worker whose job is too small for his spirit, you know? Maggie Holmes, domestic. For generations, all we've done is scrubbing. It's degrading. You can't see any tomorrow there. We want to be doctors and lawyers and teachers. Frank Decker, interstate trucker. Success means you survive. Tim Devlin, janitor, ex-salesman. A lot of people are considered failures, but it's not their fault. Brett Hauser, supermarket box boy. You have to be subservient to people. Being subservient made me resentful. Dolores Dante, waitress. I can't be servile. I give service. There's a difference. Eric Nestoranko, hockey player. It reflects the North American way of life. It's one of the ways you are somebody. You beat somebody. You're better than they are. Somebody has to be less than you in order for you to be somebody. Fred Ringley, ex-salesman, farmer. We were caught up in the American dream. You've gotta have a house. Gotta have a country club. Gotta have 2 cars. Here you are at 10 grand to getting nowhere. So I doubled my salary. I also doubled my grief. Working, working, but is it working for you? Your job doesn't mean anything. You're just a little machine. It's really unfair to ask someone to do that. You have a number, you're just an instrument. The last 3 or 4 years on the job were horrible. The computer had arrived. They give better care to that machine than they will to you. Somehow you get the feeling that the machine is better than you are. Somehow you get the feeling that the machine is better than you are. Sometimes I feel like I'm just a robot. You push a button and go this way. You're not regarded, you're just a number. Just like a prisoner. A man should be treated as a human, not as a million-dollar piece of machinery. People aren't treated as good as an IBM machine is. There ought to be a reason behind what men do. We're not just machines, but some of us live like machines. Somehow you get the feeling that the machine is better than you are. Somehow you get the feeling that the machine is better than you. I'd like to see a building, say the Empire State. I'd like to see one side of it on a foot wide strip. The name of every bricklayer, the name of every electrician, all the names. So when a guy walked by, he'd take his son and say, hey, see, that's me over there. The 45th floor, Picasso can point to a painting. walks by this building and you say, I did that. Everyone should have something to point to and say, hey, Lord. Turning, yearning, oh, how I'm searching, what could it be? Hotz Michaels, piano player. I know everything in life ends. It's not growing old that worries me, but what would I do? If I were to suddenly inherit $4 million, I guarantee you I'd be playing piano here or some other place. I can't explain why. I would miss the flow of people in and out. Lilith Reynolds, project coordinator. The reasons people get paid now are wrong. I think the reward system should be different. I think we should have basic security, a decent place to live, decent food, decent clothing, so people in a work situation wouldn't be so frightened. People are intimidated, and the system works to emphasize that. Bill Talcott, organizer. I think we have it inside us to change things. We need the courage, because we've been told from the time we were born that what we have inside us is bad and useless. What's true is what we have inside us is good and useful.
Work Cycle by Alicia Walter. All right, another big hand for Black Oak Ensemble. Let's bring them out. Bring them out, bring them out. Desiree Roostrot on violin. Come out, guys. Desiree Roostrot, violin. Aurelian Petrozzoli, viola. David Cunliffe on cello. They are the Black Oak Ensemble. Thanks to all of the composers who contributed new music tonight. Thanks so much to John Zorn and Brian Marcella for contributing music to the program tonight. Thanks to our special guests, Anna Tavis, Eric Loomis. Thanks to my co-host, Todd Lippe. Thanks to Symphony Space. Huge thanks to the New York State Council of Arts, without whose dollars we could not do this. There's no way we could do it. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening. All right, that's the end of the podcast. But for those of you who have